Iron Age, where humanity declined even further. So there was this idea that without the supervision of the gods, that civilization would decrease and collapse, and that was inevitable unless the gods oversaw humanity directly. Now we have very, very different ideas of progress, that humanity is able to change of its own will, so to speak, that our governments and people, thinkers and societies have measurable impacts on each other, and those impacts can lead to a positive future of our own creation. I don't want to sound too much like a utopian or someone who believes in ideal society. I do actually think that is something notable, is that we haven't actually touched very heavily on utopian thought in this study of literature on progress. So that might be something that's worth further study, is ideas of progress with regards to utopian societies and how those ideas are connected.
Yeah, I think Aaron and I have reached a point of disagreement. To say that now we have this idea that we can change of our own will and all that stuff. I don't necessarily think we think that. Some people think that, but I think because we live in, particularly within North America, a very multicultural society, I think there still is the ideas of the gods, in the sense of there are structures that heavily influence the decisions we make, and it's true that maybe we're not so outwardly about that. We're not like, well, the god of Jupiter hath ordained this action. But we do create, in a sense, governing belief systems based upon something more significant of narrative. I think this is what you see in existentialist thought, particularly Friedrich Nietzsche, right? His famous line, "God is dead," is usually taken out of context to say Nietzsche was such an anti-God human being. When you read that in context, you come to see that he says, "We have killed God. What should we do now? There's no one to atone. There's no one to blame for the mistakes we make." That is a challenging thing for him. I think it is. I think in the current definition of progress, there's a sense of which we are all we have, and so we are then given the burden, as Sartre says, to make decisions, especially those who are in political power, that are going to affect all of humanity, right? All of the societies affected. I don't completely disagree with Aaron's statement, but I think there's important nuance to be stated there, that especially within my area of study or specialty, so to speak, there is a great emphasis on understanding how stories and individual perceptions impact the decisions that are made.
Yes, I do think that you're very, very correct, Tegan, that it isn't as clear-cut as to say that, you know, we all believe that we are the captains of our own destiny, so to speak, and that we can direct the world wherever we want. I don't think the majority of people would believe that. I do think, though, and this is kind of one of the most interesting things about the last shows we've done on the 19th century and 20th century philosophers. The idea of progress to a better society, and that that is a real possibility that we should invest time and energy into thinking about and creating, is something that, that we as modern individuals have to deal with and grapple with more than ancient people in the ancient context did. Now, that isn't to say that people in the ancient context didn't think about how to make societies better, but just that we are forced by our modern context to consider it more often just because of the prevalence ideas in our media. Although, and perhaps this is worth thinking about, there have been, I guess, in the period that I've been growing up especially, there's been a real shift to dystopian literature. There's been a huge monumental shift that there's a very, very, very large set of literature that is dystopian in scope and speaks of the potential collapse of civilization. And some of that literature is written with the perspective of kind of the same as Diamond and Wright saying, well, if we don't take the future into our own hands, so to speak, our society will fall to collapse and to ruin. So we have to take an active role in thinking and shaping our society's actions in such a way as to avoid collapse. This is a necessary role of people in our society is to avoid collapse. Now, avoiding collapse isn't necessarily the same as ensuring growth or ensuring prosperity, and or striving even for an ideal or a better society. So those two narratives, the narrative of avoiding a collapse of society and of a group of people who believes in creating a better society, and another group of people who, for lack of better words, see the problems in society and don't see a solution and are kind of seeing the inevitable collapse of society because they don't see a solution.
You talked a little bit about Kant. It's genuinely mind-blowing. I mean, Kant was he was not just a novel thinker philosophically, but politically as well. I don't think I don't know if that was his intention to sort of like implement policy or institutions, but he certainly had aspirations that had very real consequences on the world. So that's incredible as well. But aside, I mean, unless that really is the apex of it, but you know, at the end of the series, what were some sort of highlights or what were some of the interesting things that you learned about progress? Cause I mean, going into it, you must have done it for some reason. You must have had some expectations going in about what you were going to encounter, but how did it really, like, what was the cash value of what you really bought here?
The main reason I was so interested to study this topic was because of my experience taking a computer science and ethics course. And one of the questions in that course that we talked about a lot was the ethical uses of technology. I was surprised by essentially how much philosophy this required us learning to be able to do our job as computer scientists ethically, or as people who work with technology in society and how to do that ethically. We needed to understand or go through a very long history of ideas with regards to ethics and with regards to technology. So I was curious into diving a little bit more of where the philosophical foundations for the idea of progress comes from, because I saw the idea of progress being used within the technological framework quite often. So to summarize, I think I will go back to the very beginning of the article and talk about the three main conceptual issues that this article seeks to address. So the first was, does the theory under consideration rigorously define a conception of human well-being And if so, what is it? This is probably, I think, the one that we've gotten the least satisfactory answer to. In terms of the goal of human well-being, there have been several proposed answers, but all of them are quite flawed from my perspective. None of them would work for all societies, or I would even venture to say for one society for an extended period of time. We've seen Enlightenment ideas, which have talked about scientific progress as being something that will transform societies in terms of social progress, so that scientific theoretical progress, which changed the way that people thought and interacted with nature, was thought to change the way that people behave towards each other, and that there could be this rapid type of social advancement. That type of thing was started to be theorized in the Enlightenment through the eyes of several thinkers that we talked about, some of which are Concordat, Turgot, David Hume, Adam Smith, the grandfather of economics, and Immanuel Kant. Immanuel Kant is also the person who wrote a work titled Ideas Toward a Universal History with Cosmopolitan Intent and Perpetual Peace. So the idea of universal history, more or less, we get from Kant. The idea of a theory of moral sentiments and the Wealth of Nations, the two works that are associated with Adam Smith, kind of give us they're the basis of economics, but they're also the basis in moral philosophy of the idea of prosperity as being something that we should seek to achieve as a society. And that it's, he was mainly concerned in the Wealth of Nations with the policies that would lead to his own nation's prosperity. So we covered those views, and none of those really give us a clear cut idea of what human being well-being should be. Kant is actually the one who came closest for me going through this in terms of defining rigorously what human well-being should be. The categorical imperative, stating that, you know, if everyone did this thing, then would this thing still be good? If so, then, you know, it's universalizable and you can consider it as a course of action. And then applying that to, well, you would have a republic that kind of negotiates what the public good is in a systematic fashion. And then there is a federation, a collection of these republics, then collectively negotiate. So you have all of these individual people who are trying to consider what should be done for what should one person do for the sake of every other person at an individual level. And then at a collective level, well, what should we as a community do for the sake of all people? And then as a global community, well, what should we do as a global community? Or a community of representatives for all of these communities for the sake of all people. So, yeah, Kant takes home that award, so to speak. The 19th century views and the 20th century views and the 21st century views, I think, have maybe expanded that point a little bit, but I don't think that any of them have improved upon it too well, and I'm open to being challenged on that.
Progress, by Kant's definition, seems to be, how do we create a structure in which people can develop a sense of who they are as moral agents, and also then how do we live that out within relationships? I think the idea of progress that I have seen that resonates is, right, and it comes out of work that I'm doing academically myself, is that in order to progress, you must first know where you came from. Right. And so this idea of, right, ultimately knowing where you came from and what your end goal is, and how do you derive that end goal? I think the conversation of public discourse, right, having those discussions is super key to any kind of theory or implementation of progress. And so basically what I'm saying is, I think Aaron got right that Kant has the best motivations. Does that mean we shouldn't be cautious of some of Kant's moral implications? I think we should. I think John Stuart Mill did a little better job in that regard, because not everything that is good, even if it's good when it's done by anyone, it is good all the time. So to have a conversation about the nuance of that. But I think for what Aaron is getting at and what Kant's intent was of how do we build a moral community, a moral society, I think it worked. I would just encourage our listeners to don't think that Kant is all that in a bag of chips all the time, because he's just not. But he's still a beautiful figure to look at and say how he shaped our perception of progress.
And I think it seems to me that his ideas are the ones that, whether it's intentional or unintentional, his ideas seem to be the ones that drive forward the ideas of progress into the future. And maybe that's not always the case. Maybe I'm giving him too much credit, and there are other people who deserve the credit equally. But he was the one who stood out the most, mainly because there are several thinkers to come after him who seem like they're developing their ideas in the same logical style that he developed his ideas. While they are developing very different ideas, they seem to take his style. So the second question that this article sought to answer was, what causes of long-term improvement, and especially what laws of historical development, does the theorist propose? This was the most scary part of doing this series, is that there have been people who have described historical laws of development, and I won't go into them for the sake of time, but they were just wrong. They were 100% wrong. A lot of these people were in the 19th century, some of them in the 20th century. It's kind of hard to say whether or not the environmental thinkers of today, if they are wrong where they are, their ideas just haven't been around long enough for us to see the full effect of their work. And it's always really hard to, if you think about these theorists, when they write their work, they have no idea what the reception of the work is going to be, or what its influence will be into the future. What I can say somewhat definitively is that Wright and Diamond's work with regards to environmental limitations, you could say, on progress, that human societies have very real limitations, and we need to take those limitations seriously, otherwise we're courting disaster. I can definitely see that philosophy and understanding is well spread and well adopted within the current society I live in Canada. So I would be hard pressed to say that I think you could make a pretty statistical argument that if someone did a psychological study studying a group of Canadians and they said, like, do you think that there are limits to progress based off of natural resources, I think a lot of people would say yes, with probably a variety of different conditions. But I think many people have been exposed to that idea and agree with it in some way, shape, or form. So, and I suppose that's just because the most modern thinkers. And for me, that just drives home the importance of studying progress, as problematic as it is and as hard to nail down as it is, just because it has such great influence on culture and society. Because the narratives of progress that we tell ourselves and the philosophies we use to conceptualize and understand progress are essentially what we use to say, well, these are the goals and standards by which we should judge our current society. And it's not always that clear cut. Like, you don't see like people standing up on a stage saying like our society is objectively good or bad because specifically because of this issue or because of this other thing. But it's definitely interesting to see how these philosophical frameworks were created and have become so far adopted. Now, I'll just add something for this third account, this third question, and then I'll open the floor for the last couple of minutes. So what evidence or reasons does the theorist provide for the aforementioned causal account? This is very interesting because earlier theorists rely heavily on their own reasoning and on a priori knowledge and frameworks, whereas modern accounts have taken to more empirical methods, and that essentially has really changed how we look about theories of progress, or more specifically, how we evaluate theories of progress. So now if you come up to someone with a theory of progress, they might listen to you for a little bit, but they'll say like, well, so what? Can you prove it to me? Can you offer me any empirical evidence for your theory of progress? And if the answer is no, it'll be pretty hard, I think, in the modern context for someone to take you very seriously. And so this is interesting that some authors had to deal with this conception where empirical evidence is needed or desired. Other people had more freedom, you could say, because they were let me rephrase that too. The manner of evidence that has been acceptable in different times for different societies has changed. And so that's been very interesting to it's kind of a picture into the past to see what type of evidence these different thinkers and authors have chosen, because they thought they would make it attractive or reasonable to their audience in that time frame. So it is kind of a walk through history to see all the different types of argumentation and arguments and their similarities and differences. So the main difference there for the third question, going from a priori reasoning to more empirical reasoning. And then the question for the future of what should we do in the future? Because as much as empirical evidence is good or may be valuable, you can never rely solely on empirical evidence when creating a theory, because you will always be left with you have to have some idea to evaluate, and you have to conceptualize that idea in concepts, not in numbers. You can't evaluate a theory if it's only numbers. So I think we're basically out of time, but I'll give you both 30 seconds if you want to have a finishing comment.
Progress is complicated, but if we didn't explore the issue of progress, I think we would be far worse off, because we wouldn't be willing to wrestle with the giants of what does it mean to be in relationship. And within this miniseries, you've touched on a lot of different thinkers, which I think is good. And I would encourage the listeners to, if there was one that grabbed you, go look at that. Go invest some time in that. And we would love to hear from you on our socials, why those people stood out to you, why they grabbed you.
Yeah, I definitely, from our previous episode that I was fortunate enough to get to listen into and contribute to, I know that I got to think of some new thinkers in relation to this idea of progress. Progress is not something that I'm used to kind of giving it seems almost niche, but it has a broad scope. It's like philosophers doing history in a way. You can put a sort of normative spin on it. You can evaluate it. What kind of evidence do we want to use? Some use better evidence than others, apparently. It's all very exciting. It's an interesting area to be doing philosophy, and I knew that it would be interesting because it's philosophy, but that it's so rich, I think, is what kind of surprised me, even just from the kind of the one episode or the two here that I got to listen to. So I'm glad to have gotten to contribute to this.
This has been Aaron Wang on the Canadian Philosophy Show, and today I've been joined by my co-host Brandon Brownlee and Tegan Marshall. Thank you so much for listening, and see you next time.
You can find archived recordings of the Canadian Philosophy Show on mixcloud.com/thecanadianphilosophyshow and tcps.podbean.com.